Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Term Falcon, where a player is hit on the head with a footy, emanated from a pass in a South Queensland Crushers game at Lang Park when Mario Fenwick was coming off the field to be replaced, and the dummy half Ray Herring threw the ball and hit Mario on the head. Now, at that stage, Mario and Kevy were on the panel of the Channel 9 Brisbane Footy Show. And when it came on air that night on the panel, Mario blew up deluxe. And the next ad break, Kevy was sitting beside me on the panel. Mario came over, put his arms around Kevy's neck and said, "I'm going to strangle you, you little blah, blah, blah."
Down the blind, Andrew John. Inside for Elba. Elba will score. Elba will score. Newcastle has won.
Welcome back to the Rugby League Guru Podcast. Today, I'm lucky enough to bring you a fantastic interview with a champion bloke, Tony Durkin. Now, Tony, he was the Queensland editor of Rugby League Week in the 80s and the 90s, and then he went on to be the media manager of the Brisbane Broncos. During his time at the Broncos, they won two premierships in the year 2000 and in the year 2006, which was Tony's final year at the Brisbane Broncos. He essentially had to leave because his relationship with Wayne Bennett wasn't overly great, and it's sort of been a common occurrence across his career. He's obviously been the Queensland editor of Rugby League Week, had to come in contact with Wayne Bennett a lot of the time. They've always had a bit of a rocky relationship. So to hear Tony talk about that in this interview really is sensational to hear. As I said, he was on the ground Rugby League Week during the 1980s when Queensland Rugby League was really exploding. And then 1988, the Brisbane Broncos are born. And Tony had a very unique perspective on this, obviously from the football side of things, but also the business side of things, which Tony will touch on. He just knows everything about Queensland Rugby League from the last 40 years. A fantastic little history lesson coming up here on obviously the clubs, but also players. We talk about Mal Meninga, Alan Langer, Gene Miles, Wally Lewis, all of these champion footballers. And Tony, obviously being a journalist, got to know them. The relationship with players was very different back then, but he was also able to go on three kangaroo tours and mingle in with all the players. That's in 1986, 1990, and 1994. This is a cracking interview with Tony. As I said, it's only part one. There's going to be three parts coming over the next 2 weeks where we dive into Super League, Brisbane Broncos, everything that Tony's been through during his incredible career in rugby league. This is a sensational chat. I can't wait to bring it to you. Let's kick it off. Tony, welcome on. How are we, mate?
Very well, Nathan. Yourself?
Yeah, going good. Now, obviously, the listeners would have picked up from your name in the introduction. We're obviously related, unfortunately. What's the deal there?
Fortunately, I don't know about
unfortunately
that.
Well, for you, I was going to say.
Oh, no, well, your grandfather, Des, is my first cousin, so we'll have to work it out from there.
We're cousins. I was with the grandparents on the weekend trying to work it out, and it was not easy.
Well, we're cousins, and we both love one thing in particular, rugby league.
Now, mate, obviously you've carved an unbelievable career out of our great sport, rugby league. Where did it all start for you? Like, as a young bloke, when was your first interest in rugby league?
Oh, back when I was probably 6 or 7 years of age. We lived on a rural property in northwestern New South Wales, and rather than me be interested in sheep and cattle and wheat and driving tractors and riding horses, I I kind of went towards sport, rugby league in particular. Our little primary school was only less than 100 people or 100 kids, so there was no competition until I went to boarding school in Armidale when I was 12 years of age, and then I started to play competitive sport, rugby league and rugby union, actually, at De La Salle in Armidale, where actually your grandfather, Des, actually went to De La Salle in Armidale as well.
How did he go with the ball in hand?
I'm not sure. He was there before me, so I'm not sure. You Des Durkin's cousin. There was none of that, so I'm not quite sure that Des started as a footy player, but no, I straight away loved it. Probably the best 6 years, some of the best 6 years of my life at boarding school, the camaraderie and the competition, and that's where I started to get a competitive edge and loved it. I loved it from then on.
And I believe whilst you were there, mate, you started to write a couple of articles for the school magazine and whatnot.
On sport, and that got me, that whet my appetite in journalism and in sport, and I started off as a cadet journalist on the Inverell paper, then went to Glen Innes, then Grafton, and in 1980, my twin brother, actually, Chris, found an advertisement in the summer edition of Rugby League Week and rang me and said, do you know that Queensland's looking for an editor of Rugby League Week? And that's one thing I always wanted to do, and I applied for the job and got it and moved north and have not left.
Must look back at that phone call and think, you must just pinch yourself. What a life-changing moment.
It certainly was, Nathan. It was wonderful. And as fate would have it, when I first went to Brisbane in 1980 as the first editor of Rugby League Week in Queensland, prior to that, Rugby League Week had been going for about 8 or 9 years. But they just had stringers in Queensland supplying news, in inverted commas. It wasn't really news. It was rehashed news that was probably published a week to 10 days later. So I was the first editor up there to actually be singly employed by Rugby League Week and not you know, take copy from other journos. But at the same time, 4BC in Brisbane, the radio station 4BC, was granted sole commercial rights to cover the game in Brisbane. So a guy called John McCoy, who was the rugby league caller on 4BC, and I did a deal, whereas he would write a column for Rugby League Week to get his name out there in the public domain, and I became his co-commentator on the footy call. So we both developed our name from that little venture, which turned into a long career for me in not only in print journalism, but in radio and also TV in a long period of time in working in Brisbane. So it was great, fantastic.
Mate, I imagine coming from your humble beginnings, small town, Brisbane must have hit you like a train.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it did. It's not, Brisbane then wasn't quite as grown up as it is now back in 1980. But yeah, it was still pretty dramatic for me at that stage. But, you know, I was focused on what I wanted to do. I had two little kids, a wife and two little kids back then, and it changed our lives dramatically, but for the better. We've just had the most wonderful, wonderful life, and my career took off from there.
And mate, but before we do get into your career, obviously you did play footy when you were growing up. I believe you played as an outside back, and you eventually gave up the game because of a heap of concussions, essentially. Is that right?
Yeah, interesting. That's the big topic around at the moment. I was no gun as a footballer. I actually represented Group 5 in that northern New South Wales area in Northern Division trials a couple of times. Didn't go any further than that. In the last year I played, 1972, I was hospitalised 3 times with concussion. And, having a journalistic career, I thought was probably a better prospect for me than a football career. So I gave it away then. And now I have the odd story about, gee, what's that bloke's name? Gee, I know his face, but what's his name? So it wasn't that severe back then, but I think it was a very smart decision that I made.
No, you've definitely made worse decisions. Can I ask you, back then when you did give up the game on the back of concussions, I mean, from what I've gathered, the culture back then was sort of a get up, deal with it, keep moving. It's very different to how it is now. Was there any eyebrows raised towards you? Was there teammates that sort of thought, what on earth is he doing? What was the go around that?
Oh, not really. I think they understood. I had a I'd just been married. I had a son, and I had another son on the way. So it was a practical decision as well. And it was difficult for me because I used to have to write the reports in the local paper on the footy, and you know, footy in those days in the bush, you'd play on Sundays, and like we'd go to places like Moree and two and a half, 3 hour trips to places to play footy. And by the time I got home from the game on the Sunday, it was probably close to midnight, and then I'd have to be up at Sparrows to write the report. So it was a pretty tough gig, actually, and you know, I didn't mind the fact that I finally gave it away. I missed it, but that's life.
Take me back to when you arrived in Brisbane, mate. I'm imagining that you wouldn't have had too many connections around the game at that stage. I imagine that must have made it a little bit difficult for you.
It was pretty tough, actually. I'm trying to think of anyone that I did know in Brisbane. I don't think there was too many people I did actually know. But the Brisbane competition had started to take off. And don't get me wrong, I'm not trying to bemoan the quality of the game before I got there. 1980 was a real turning point for the game in Brisbane because some of the coaches up there at the time, Frank Stanton, actually moved to Brisbane that year to coach Redcliffe. Bobby McCarthy, the great Bob McCarthy, was coaching South in Brisbane in his first stint. A guy called Ross Strudwick was there. There's Morris. Graham Lowe, the Kiwi coach, was there. Wayne Bennett, Ronnie Rafe were a famous name. So that was the ilk of the coaching fraternity in Brisbane at the time. So the game was really about to take off. And of course, my first job was to go around and introduce myself to all these guys. And 99.9% of them were pleased to see me, except one bloke, my old mate Wayne Bennett.
I reckon I could have guessed that one.
It was interesting. I went out, he was coaching Brothers at the time, and I went out and watched the team train and waited till most of the people had left and walked up to Wayne and put my hand out and said, Wayne, my name's Tony Durkin. I'm the new editor of Rugby League Week in Queensland. And he looked at me and went, so? So that was my introduction to Wayne. And even though I went on to work for the Broncos for quite a long period of time, our relationship was okay, but we were never the best of mates, put it that way.
And, mate, of course, we are going to touch on Wayne pretty heavily later, aren't we?
I hope so.
I'm looking forward to it. Mate, tell me, of the other coaches there that you mentioned, like Bob McCarthy's one that I'm really interested in, what was he like as a bloke?
Absolutely fantastic. And when he finished coaching, or maybe when he finished coaching, I think it was, we did do some commentary together on 4BC, Bobby and I. He was just a fantastic bloke, but it was interesting. His wife, Judy, would say, Durko, I can't believe that you support Queensland in State of Origin. We're born in New South Wales. You can't take where you were born. You can't take that out of your system. And Bobby was the same. Of course, they were both obviously staunch New South Wales people. But I used to ghost Bobby, actually. Bobby McCarthy had a column in Rugby League Week, and I used to ghost Macca, and sometimes I'd ring him and say, Macca, any idea what we're going to talk about today? And, oh, gee, I don't know, Durko, what do you reckon? I said, well, what about X, Y, Z? What do you think? Yeah, mate, yeah, let's talk about that. Why don't you write something and ring me back, which I do, and I'd ring him back and read it to him. He'd say, mate, you know me better than I know myself. Just a great character, a wonderful bloke, great footballer, and a terrific fella.
Tony, you mentioned obviously 1980, a bit of a turning point for Queensland Rugby League, and over the next 8 years, it would only get better, of course, the introduction of the Brisbane Broncos, the Gold Coast Giants. When did you first start to get an idea that, you know, those two sides, especially the Broncos coming into the New South Wales Rugby League, that was going to be a reality?
The four businessmen who launched the Broncos, Barry Moran, Paul Morgan, Steve Williams and Gary Borken, were all ex-rugby league players who played representative footy in Brisbane. Very, very influential business people who could see the need for a team in what was then not actually the national competition, but it certainly was a competition that was growing. And Queensland was producing so many good players that. And they all were going to Sydney. Any player in Queensland worth their salt back then was playing in Sydney by the time those teams came into the competition. And that was going to continue unless they could stay at home and play in that top flight competition. But I was not I won't say I was closely involved in the development of the Broncos, but certainly they had my ear at certain stages, the Miranda consortium on various things. And, you know, it was a pleasure to be involved with them.
Mate, one player I want to ask you about from that era is, of course, Wally Lewis. I think people my age and younger, that generation, because, you know, he only came into the NRL competition in 88, they don't understand what he achieved before that and how much of a brilliant player he was. Give us an insight to Wally Lewis. You obviously saw a lot of his career.
Actually, the first game I saw Wally play, it was the very first game I saw when I went to Brisbane. It was a trial match between Valleys, Wally's club, and Brisbane North's, which was coached by Graham Lowe. And a guy called Mark Graham, probably one of the, up there, he probably in my top 10 best players of all time, Mark Graham, just a wonderful, wonderful player and a great talent. He'd just come over from New Zealand. It was his first game for North, and he actually broke Wally's jaw. Now, Wally thinks it was on purpose. I don't think it was on purpose. I think it was accidental. It was a bit of a blue, and Mark Graham came running in, as players do, but I don't think he threw a punch. I just think it was an unfortunate clash. But that was the first time I saw Wally play. And Wally was actually, we had a photograph on the front page of Rugby League Week. I'm not sure whether it was in the national edition or just the Queensland edition, of Wally's head swathed in bandages, sitting there looking very sad. So I didn't see him for a few weeks after that. But you could tell, as soon as I saw him play, you could tell he was a brilliant talent. He was a bit lazy. A lot of New South Wales people thought that, even when he played for Australia and Queensland at times. But he just knew how to pace himself out on the footy field. Wally, he was just a magnificent competitor. You know, when the stakes were the highest, he played at his very, very best. And that was at State of Origin 99.9% of the time. Club football, he used to coast a little bit probably, but he was always head and shoulders above everyone else. He could defend magnificently. He was like, he reminded me a lot of Sturlow and Jonathan Thurston and Cameron Smith and those wonderful players, who was probably one or two plays ahead of everyone else on the field. He could see what was going to unfold. But yeah, he stands, Wally, in my opinion, is the number one player in the game that I've seen.
Who are the guys for you that are just under him? You know, is it Sterling? Is it Joey? Who are the guys that you have around that mark of Wally then?
Oh, Joey Johns. He probably had more string to his bow than Wally. They were very, very similar players, Wally and Andrew Johns. Andrew Johns, the other string that he had to his bow that Wally did was his magnificent goal kicking. Wally actually could kick goals if he had to and if he wanted to, but not as proficiently as Andrew Johns. They're my top two, but it's very hard to split them. You know, I said Thurston, Cameron Smith, Brad Fittler, Sterlow, Ray, I mean, Bobby Fulton. You know, I remember back that far, Reg Gasnier, Graham Langlands. I'm old enough to remember those blokes when they were in their prime. Johnny Raper. There's been some wonderful players, and it's all about individual opinion, and that's my opinion. Wally number one, Joey very, very closely number two.
Take me to the start of the Brisbane Broncos, 1988. They've just come into the competition. And what was your thoughts of them when they first entered? Did you think they were going to be an instant success? Do you think they were going to struggle for the first couple of years? How did they, what, like, I want to know what the optics of the Brisbane Broncos look like in 88 when they came in for you.
Well, they had a good side. They had very, very talented players. Wally was 28, 27. So not, I'd say he was, if he wasn't in his prime, he was pretty close to it. Gene Miles, they were the first two that the Broncos signed. And once they signed Wally and Gino, there was a flood of really good players that came along. Greg Dowling, Brian Niebling, some of their forwards were probably a little longer in the tooth and maybe getting towards the end of their careers, but they'd played State of Origin and they'd played Test football. So, you know, the standard of the team was very, very high, as was exemplified by the fact that they smashed Manly, the Premiers, in their very first game. But as the season progressed, you could tell that the week-to-week tough competition and the travel, and that's something that a lot of people don't take into consideration, Like the Broncos had to travel every second week, something that they weren't used to. And I think that took a toll on them. But, you know, they were always competitive right from the very start. And even though it took them 4 years to win a comp, they were always, you know, they were always thereabouts in those early days.
I mean, it's obviously during this time that you enter into a bit of commentary yourself. Tell me about that.
I'm not quite sure how it started. As I said earlier, I did some broadcasting on 4BC, and then when they came into the competition, Channel 10 actually had the rights back then, and Queenslanders being Queenslanders are not very trusting. In fact, we're probably paranoid, actually, us blokes up here. So Channel 10 in Queensland said, well, look, we think the Channel 10 commentary team in Sydney might be a bit biased against our boys. So we're going to have our own commentary team. So they selected a commentary team. I wasn't didn't do anything in the initial year, but the next year, 89, there was Billy J. Smith, David Fordham, a guy called David Wright, who played for Australia back in the 70s, and myself. We'd do the Broncos. So the Broncos played at home on a Friday night, or we'd cover that game for just the Queensland audience. And then the Sunday game, wherever it was, it might be at Parramatta, or it might be in Canberra, we'd fly down and cover that game as well. So that was good fun. That was really, really good fun. That lasted, I think, for 3 or 4 years, and Channel 9 took it over from then, and I did a bit of work for them. And we had a footy show, a Channel 9 Brisbane or Queensland footy show. That went for 3 or 4 years as well. And, in fact, the 1990 Kangaroo Tour, I was on the sideline for Channel 10 on that tour with Graeme Hughes, David Morrow, and Graeme Lowe. So, mate, I had great fun. It was terrific, absolutely terrific.
Mate, you mentioned the Channel 9 having their own Brisbane footy show. One guy you're on there with was, of course, Kevy Walters. Tell me about him, mate. Obviously, just started his new coaching role at the Brisbane Broncos. Hasn't started overly well for him. Tell me about the bloke that he is.
He's a champion. I love him, and I'm not too butch to say that. I love him to death. He's just a little champion, little bloke. The entire family is five Walters boys in that family, and every one of them wore a maroon jersey for Queensland as a junior. And of course, Kevin, Kerrod, and Steve all played for Australia and wore the maroon in State of Origin as well. He's a terrific bloke, and I think. People saw in the last 20 minutes of that game against the Bulldogs on the weekend that when the Broncos hit their straps, they're going to play some very, very entertaining football. But an interesting story about the footy show. Now, I think most people will probably be aware that the term falcon, where a player is hit on the head with a footy, emanated from a pass in a South Queensland Crushers game at Lang Park when Mario Fenwick was coming off the field to be replaced, and the dummy half Ray Herring threw the ball and hit Mario on the head. Now, at that stage, Mario and Kevy were on the panel of the Channel 9 Brisbane footy show. So we've gone up for our meeting before we went to air. We always had a meeting, and the director would say, now we're going to show this, this, and this. And they showed the footage of that. And Mario said, you're not going to show that, are you? Yeah, oh, yeah, yeah. No, we're not going to show that. We're not going to show that. That's embarrassing to me, blah, blah, blah. So away it went. Anyway, we decided we weren't going to show it. Kevy, after we'd had the meeting, went back to the director and said, you've got to put that in. If that was me or Peter Jackson was on the panel, or Peter Jackson or Gary Belcher or any of these other guys, you'd run it, and because Mario's blown up, you're not going to run it. So the director ran it, and when it came on air that night on the panel, Mario blew up deluxe. And the next ad break, Kevy was sitting beside me on the panel. Mario came over, put his arms around Kevy's neck and said, I'm going to strangle you, you little blah, blah, blah. And that's typical of the Kevy Walters, you know, just a real larrikin, but a bloke who says, it's got to be fair. You've got to be fair. You've got to deal with everybody in the same way. And that typifies to me the Kevy Walters I know. But he's changed a lot. He's much more serious now, Kevy, than I think has been in the past. And I hope for his sake, particularly, and the team that I follow, the Broncos, that he can get them back on track.
Might have been embarrassing for him at the time, but I reckon that little clip has done massive overs for Mario Fenning.
Probably the best. No, I was going to say the best thing he did in his career. That's very unfair. He was a very tough bloke, old Mario, and I think he's had a few head knocks in his time, Mario, but a really good fella who loves rugby league as well and has done a lot for the game. But you're right, the Falcon, that's what it's called after, the great Mario Fenwick.
Mate, it is one thing I'll say about Mario. Obviously, with me working in Sydney in a lot of schools, he's over the years done a lot of trips to schools, and geez, he is fantastic with the kids. Like, he's one of the guys that comes out, and you know, all the kids in this younger generation don't exactly know who he is, but just his energy around the game is just unreal.
No, his energy when he played was unreal too. He never gave an inch. But no, he's a terrific fellow, Mario. I don't think his stint with the Queensland Crushers was probably the most successful thing he did in his career, or probably the wisest. But we got to know him, and I'm very thankful for that.
Mate, you mentioned before we started recording about the pilot strike of 1989, and of course yourself being on TV. It was a pretty good wicket at that time. Tell me about that period.
Yeah, that was interesting. I think it kicked off just before the final started, the national pilot strike. And because we were covering all these other games that I spoke about earlier, we hired a private jet. Channel 10 hired a private jet for us to travel to and from all those games. I think it was over a 5-week period. We even though the Broncos and the Giants back then weren't figuring in the finals, we still covered every game. I think it was either 5 or 6 weeks. We travelled away every week in this flash jet with leather seats and all the bells and whistles. It was very good. I mean, they were the days when TV, whether they did or not, I don't know, seemed to have a lot of money, and there was no expense spared, and it was a bit selfish, but very nice to be involved in it.
Mate, you're obviously no stranger to an aeroplane, going on 3 kangaroo tours, kicking off in 1986. Tell me about that tour, mate.
Well, that was an eye-opener. I'd been to England once before in 1984 after I'd been to a game in France. I'll just digress a little. There was a game in France in 1984 in Paris, actually, to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the birth of the game in France. And there was a team from Oceania selected to play a team from Europe. So the Oceania team was made up of Australia, New Zealand and Papua New Guinea, playing a team from England or Great Britain, which was, you know, mostly England, but I think a couple of Welsh players, and there might have been a Scot or an Irishman in there. And, of course, the Wally Lewis, Gene Miles, Wayne Pearce, Ray Price is a pretty strong, Mark Crame, pretty strong Oceania side, and they whipped the Great Britain side. But it was the first time I ever saw Elry Hanley play, and Elry Hanley was to the southern hemisphere was virtually unknown. No one had heard of him, and I saw him play, and he scored the only try, and he was just electric. And I remember I wrote a story, a big colour feature in Rugby League Week on this guy, and sent it back to my boss Ian Heads, and he said, "Dirk, are you sure you're giving this bloke a big rap? You sure he's this good?" I said, "I think so." Anyway, that was good judgment. But 1986 Kangaroo Tour, captained by the great Wally Lewis, and Rugby League Week took away supporters' tours. I think we had about 120 people, 3 busloads, might have been a few more than that went over. And Wally Lewis's mum and dad, Jimmy and June, were actually on the bus, the tour, the supporters bus that I led. And as a result of that, we had some influence over the team management and the coach. And after the second test match, the entire Kangaroo squad of 28 players and coaching staff and management came to a luncheon that we had on for our supporters and stayed for dinner and probably stayed for 3 or 4 hours. It was just the most unbelievably wonderful experience that I had the pleasure of interviewing some of the players and the coach and our supporters. You can imagine how starry-eyed they were. But
if you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet Plush Care, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
That was a wonderful, wonderful trip. Of course, undefeated, the second Kangaroo team in 4 years to go through the tour undefeated, and what a wonderful team. Mal Meninga couldn't even make the side. That's how good it was back then.
Wow.
Couldn't make the starting side. He was on the bench. Gene Miles and Brett Kenny were in the centres, and when Mal came on, he came and played in the back row. He was, of course, big enough to play in the back row, but that's how good that side was.
Tony, I'm just having a look through this squad on that 86 tour, and of course, you know, the vast majority of players are from Sydney clubs. There's a handful of guys from the Queensland competition. Was it pretty tough for those guys to break into this team?
86, was the first clean sweep that New South Wales had in State of Origin, actually, so maybe it was. But, you know, guys like Greg Dowling, Wally, Gino, Brian Neely was in that side. Les Kiss. I think Les Kiss was in Sydney at that stage, but he's a Queenslander, of course. Gary Belcher was the fullback. So a lot of them were not from Brisbane itself, but were Queenslanders playing in the national competition. But no, they more than held their own, no doubt about that. They weren't just passengers in that side. They were dead set, fair dinkum Kangaroos in that very, very successful team.
Was Wally Lewis an automatic selection as skipper in that side?
Yeah, he was. He was the Australian captain at that stage, and he was very, very influential. He and Sterlo were the halves, of course. Brett Kenny, a lot of people would think that Brett Kenny should have been the 5'8", but he played in the centres, as I just said, and that was a very good side. But Wally had a very unfortunate tour in 1982 when he went over as vice-captain of the 82 team, and I think after the first test match was dropped, and Brett Kenny and Sterlo were the halves for the rest of that tour. So Wally had some ground to make up from 1982, but certainly did it. No, he was 1986, I reckon Wally was probably at his prime.
Mate, obviously this 1986 tour, they're very different to, you know, the occasional Kangaroo tour you see now. From your experiences with this 86 side, who was the best off ground for you?
Ground. Socially?
Socially, yeah. Star-studded by the looks of it.
Oh, yeah, they're right. Look, it was the media. I didn't spend on the 1990 tour, I actually stayed in the same hotel as the players. We were based in Manchester. Whereas in 1986 and then in earlier Kangaroo tours, they stayed in the Dragonara Hotel in Leeds, but would go to, say they went to Sheffield to play. Well, they might stay the night in Sheffield, or they went to somewhere else and played. They, you know, even though Leeds was their base, they'd go away and stay, you know, two or three nights somewhere else. But they didn't do that in 1990. They stayed in the one hotel in Manchester. So. And the media stayed in the same hotel, so we got to know them a lot better. But 86, mate, they're all good. No one particularly stands out to me as being more social than anybody else. But just a period in the game when the players and the media seemed to get on pretty well together. And it was, you know, you'd go down for a drink in the hotel bar at 6 o'clock or 5 o'clock of an afternoon, there'd be two or three players there, and you'd just wander over and have a beer with them. That's how it was back then.
Take me to the 1990 Kangaroo Tour, mate. And obviously, you know, now the Brisbane Broncos, they're established. The Penrith Panthers, they're on the rise. The Canberra Raiders are flying. That squad obviously looked very different 4 years later.
It did. A lot of similarities. Of course, there was, again, controversy and, again, involving Wally Lewis. He was in line to be in that side and be one of the first players, I think, to tour, or he would have joined a band of players to tour with, make three successive Kangaroo tours. He'd broken his arm towards the end of the season, and he was picked in the side and underwent a fitness test in Sydney just before the team was to leave, and failed. Dr. Bill Monaghan failed him. It was huge controversy, and Wally didn't make the trip. I think Wayne Pearce might have come in as his replacement in that 1990 team. But it was a great team again in 1990. But it was interesting that they got beaten in the first test, and of course with the time difference between England and Australia, Rugby League Week would go to bed on a Monday or a Sunday night, but having a gloss coloured cover, that had to be done on the Friday. So you had to be thinking pretty much ahead. And because Australia was so dominant in the early games, the powers that be back in Sydney put some photos of some Australian players on the cover and wrote right across the top, "Champs." And that was to be the cover to come out on the next week when the magazine went to press. Well, of course, Australia got beaten in that test match. Unbelievably, it was one of the biggest upsets for a long, long time. So rather than change the cover totally, somebody smarter than me, and probably not so much smarter than a lot of other people, crossed out the A in champs and put a U up the top and had it. And the cover said "Chumps" because Australia would get beaten. Well, you can imagine Bobby Fulton, angry little Bobby Fulton, the coach, what he thought of that. So another luncheon that we'd planned to have with the Australian team, because I think on that trip we had 600 people from Rugby League Week supporters tours. They boycotted it. The team boycotted the lunch with our players. Bobby Fulton boycotted that lunch. No one's allowed to go. And the great Bobby Linder turned up. He defied his coach and said, no, I'm going to go and meet the fans. And Bob Linder was the only Australian player that came on that trip. But it was interesting, of course, that trip, as you would remember, Nathan, I think, and a lot of people would remember, or maybe not remember, but know now, that was the second test. Australia looked like they were going to be beaten, or be down 2-0 after two test matches, until Ricky Stewart grabbed an intercept and big Mal Meninga ran away and scored that unbelievable try. And I was on the sideline for Channel 10 back then, so that was very exciting and great to be there.
Mate, I think for me it's one of my favourite moments in rugby league history, seeing, you know, Ricky Stewart just being the competitor he is. He obviously throws that intercept and all of a sudden this team that simply couldn't lose, it looks like they're going to win this series in the first two games, and then he comes up with an unbelievable play. I love that footage of Mal. He's just going shoulder to shoulder in the background of Ricky Stewart and he finds him. It must have been an unbelievable moment to be there for.
Well, it was, and as I said, it was 600, I think, Rugby League Week supporters, but there are other supporters' stores there from Australia as well. I think the English pound was much more competitive back in those days with the Australian dollar. And, I don't know whether Rugby League enjoyed a more buoyant time than back in the late 80s and early to mid-90s. It was wonderful, and people just were totally in love with the game. And to see the sea of green and gold in the stands at Old Trafford when Big Mal Ricky, first of all, made the break, and Big Mal and ET were involved in it. It was just one, almost the full length of the field. It was one of the great moments for me in my association with rugby league, and I think a lot of people in Australia.
Now, Tony, I know you had a couple of nights out with this squad. Tell me about those.
We had some good times. I remember one night Johnny Cartwright and MG and I and a couple of journos. They were in the second team, or the Emus, I think. Johnny Cartwright and MG. They didn't make the test side back in those days, but we had some good times. And as I said, it was the players and the journos back then got on very well together. There was a trust there. Between the two groups, and you know, we did our jobs, and they were respectful of that. But you know, when it came time to socialise, the players back then didn't have any issues at all of, as I said, having a drink or going out on the town with the boys, with the journos. It was good fun.
Mate, obviously, before you go on your third tour in 94, there is the 1992 Rugby League World Cup, of course. Where was this one played?
At Wembley, actually. I think it was one of the very last sporting events to be played at Wembley Stadium. And I think it was Spud Carroll who might have taken his boots off and put them in the, you know, some of those ceilings these days, you can push the tile up, and just a timber tile, push it up and I think he put his boots up there, Mark Spud Carroll in the dressing room at Wembley. But you know, that was a terrific game, a great final. Kevvy Wallace actually was involved in that. He's that famous cutout pass to the flying Steve Renoff to score in the corner, and Australia won that World Cup. And then a week later, we went to Wigan. The Broncos, who were the premiers in 1992, played Wigan for the World Club Championships, which they won as well. And there's an interesting story there about the rogue Julian O'Neill, who was a terrific bloke, Julian, but unfortunately Julian didn't know when he knew when to start his partying, but unfortunately he didn't know when to stop it, and he got into a lot of trouble over that. But on the morning of the game, they went down to a local betting shop, and I think Julian saw that he was might have been 25-1 or something to score the first try, and he thought, "Oh, that's not a bad idea," and whacked some dollars on himself, and he did. He scored the first try and became a wealthy little man for a little while until he always knew how to get rid of his money, Julian. So it probably didn't last long, but that was tremendous. And that's I remember that we got back to the hotel at Wigan after that, and the rule then, and I think it might have even come from the teetotal coach Wayne Bennett, no one goes to bed tonight. The Broncos have won the premiership. I think half a dozen of their players played in the World Cup final, and then a week later they won the World Club Championship. So that was a huge couple of weeks for the Broncos.
Mate, one bloke
I'll just add there that a couple of blokes called Kevvy Walters and Alfie Langer led the partying.
Mate, I was just about to ask Alf. I don't think he needed an approval to not go to bed. Tell me about him. You obviously would have spent a number of years around Alf. What sort of a bloke is he?
A champion. Absolute champion. Very, very shy. Very reserved until he gets a bit of lunatic soup into him, and then he relaxes and becomes a party animal when he's got into trouble a couple of times for that, Alfie. But just a brilliant little bloke from Ipswich, no airs and graces. I think the accolades that are packed on Alfie for his playing ability embarrass him somewhat. He's a guy who loves his footy, loves the punt, loves to socialise, loves his family, and he's just a terrific bloke. I reckon if you did a poll of rugby league players in Queensland, there's the most popular, Alfie would probably be top of the list.
Mate, another guy that was pretty popular up there, and you did mention him before, scoring a try in that World Cup final, Steve Renoff, obviously went on to have a fantastic career at the Brisbane Broncos. When was the first time you saw him up there?
He came in the second year, 1989. I think Steve came down from Mergen, where Brian Niebling was from. He came down. He initially played for South in Brisbane. But he was one of those players, Steve, that you just saw, when you saw him play, first time you saw him play, you thought, this kid's going to be something. And there's a lot of players you see. When you first see a player, you think the same thing. And a lot of them, particularly as juniors, don't seem to kick on, but he was one who did. And very, very proud Indigenous man, Steve. He's got five beautiful kids who are all grown up now, and just terrific bloke as well, Steve. And you know, there's not too many players I've met over my career, Nathan, that I consider to be good fellas. Genuine, hard-working, love to have a good time, but when the work's on, they're prepared to sit down and do it. But he was a wonderful player. He would glide across the field, Steve Renoff, and one of the great attributes he seemed to have, and I think he did have, was with his palm. He'd palm a player, and he could accelerate at the same time. It was like he used it as a forge to get away from the defending player. He marvellous, and of course he was well known for his headgear.
Mate, I love that try. You know better than me whether it's 92 or 93 where he bounces over
92.
The try line. Yeah, 92, unbelievable scenes there.
Wolfe would nearly caught him though.
He got close, didn't he?
He did. But Steve would say, yeah, but I was carrying the football. They're heavy, those bloody footballs.
Mate, take me to the 1994 Kangaroo Tour, and, you know, a sign of the times here. There's 13 players coming from the Canberra Raiders and the Brisbane Broncos. Pretty impressive for those two clubs.
Yeah, well, they dominated, didn't they, that period of the ARL back in those days. And, yeah, again, there's just very, 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 very good players, talented players. You know, the Brad Clydes, the Laurie Daly's, Ricky Stewart. And a bit of a changing in the guard back then. I think Kerrod Walters might have been gone away as hooker, and did his brother succeed him? I just can't quite remember that, but there were three Walters boys on that trip, Kevin, Kerrod and Steve, which was, you know, a record for Australia to send away three players, three brothers in the one Kangaroo team. But all these tours run into each other for me, mate. That far back, I find it hard to recall what actually happened.
Well, mate, I guess one thing that would make it harder, there was one common figure in all these tours, Mal Meninga. This is his fourth Kangaroo tour. Incredibly impressive.
Well, he was a giant of a man, wasn't he? On and off the field, Mal. And remember when I first went to Brisbane, Mal was very, very almost timid. Mal, and he talks about it now as he was racially vilified back then, and he didn't stand up for himself, and he looks back on that and is a little embarrassed about the fact that he didn't. He was a monolith. He was just so big and strong, and he was in the coppers back then. He was in the police force, so you know, it was easy to attack a policeman when he's not on the field, not physically but verbally, and there were some pretty tough hombres around in the Brisbane teams back in those days. But he grew, he developed. The thing he did certainly was to go to Canberra under the coaching of initially Don Ferner and then Wayne Bennett for one season. And then, of course, Tim Sheens, who I'm sure he'll say probably turned him into the player that he became. And then, of course, he turned his hand to coaching, not as a club coach. He wasn't all that successful as a club coach, but as soon as he took over Queensland and then Australia, his coaching career blossomed. And he's an immortal, deserves to be an immortal without any shadow of doubt. And I think time will judge Mal as probably one of the very influential people in Australian rugby league.
Mate, where do you sit him as far as, you know, the most damaging outside backs we've ever seen? I know you mentioned like Reg Gasnier and some of these guys from years ago earlier. Where do you sit Mal as far as all of those fellas go?
Didn't mention him earlier, did I? When I went through that list of all the great players, and it's hard to remember them all, but yeah, he's up there with the best. There's no, look, when he wanted to, Mal could run over the top of anybody. He was just a machine, and look, he was such a big man. He had thighs like tree trunks and big hands that could palm people off. And of course, he was a very accomplished goal kicker, a tough poker too in his day. Mal kicked, seven from seven in the first State of Origin on his 20th birthday. So he's a fair goal kicker as well. But now when Mal wound up and wanted to get to that, to the goal line, nine times out of 10, he could do it. No, he was a wonderful talent. I put it this way, mate. When I was playing footy, I would have hated to have tackled Mal Meninga. I would have said, there you go, mate. There's the passage. There you go.
Oh, I couldn't have tackled Mal 20 years ago, now or 20 years later. Not a hope in hell.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.